Good morning. I'm opening this meeting of the House Interim Committee on Revenue. Monday, November 18th, we have three items on the agenda, and we will do the items in the order in which they're printed. The first item is, these are all informational meetings. We will not be having sign-up testimony as we do for a public hearing. We already have presentations planned so that the committee can get updates and a better understanding of the current situation in each of these three areas. So I'm opening the informational meeting. Our first topic is an update on Interstate Broadcasters, the report.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Chris Alanek, Legislative Revenue Office. Caitlin Harger is here with me. And the Interstate Broadcast, this is an update on a report required by Senate Bill 193 related to the taxation of interstate broadcasters, how they've been taxed. And just, we're going to go through a little bit of background, but since the end of session, Kate and I had various meetings with industry folks and the Department of Revenue to get both perspectives on this issue and to try and understand DOR's perspective, DOJ's perspective, DOR/DOJ, as well as the industry perspective. And through those conversations, there are certainly certain areas that we've stepped into that are sensitive. And so the information we're providing here, we're gonna try and stay clear. This is just our take on the topic. It doesn't represent the industry's perspective or DOR's perspective. Sometimes we're going to get into those areas, so we're going to be try and be very clear about when we're doing that, but it doesn't represent them. This is just our take on the understanding with the goal, some advice, and a report that is due next month for the legislature to consider in February on how this industry or these taxpayers should be taxed. So the outline for the presentation here, we have about 10 slides. And just each one of these things, just real quickly, one slide on corporate tax terminology. This is just to ease everybody into this topic. I don't imagine corporate taxation is at the top of the list of things people want to consider on a Monday morning. And given some varied background for folks, there, one of the challenges in understanding corporate taxation is the terminology. So just touching on a few points there. And then we go over some key policy questions. And these are questions that have come up over the past 5 years that we've had this temporary policy in place. And we're trying to make progress on those so that we basically understand the industry, how they're taxed or how they should be taxed and those kinds of things. And then there are various court cases. And we're gonna walk through that. Kate has spent a lot of time listening or getting up on the court cases. There are a number of court cases that generally are for tax years prior to 2014. And understanding the legal debates that are going on there. She's not gonna go through all of the pieces, but try and highlight some of the relevant issues from our perspective. And then the fourth thing is to go through the industry description. This is something that Kate and I have had a lot of conversations on as we try to understand the industry and to provide advice to the committee on the taxation. In the MPA folks have provided various charts on the industry structure, and we've been trying to take our own stab at processing that. And then finally land on some potential tax policy alternatives. That this is kind of where we are thinking right now, and these aren't final, but this is an insight into where we're going with the report that's due next month. So the first thing, just to touch base on, to greatly oversimplify corporate taxation into four terms. The first one is this issue of nexus. And this is simply whether or not Oregon can tax a company. Now, every one of these issues gets very complicated, but the starting point is if a company has nexus, then Oregon has the right to tax that company. If the company does not have nexus, then Oregon can't tax them. And for the longest time, this meant some sort of physical presence, that a corporation was physically in the state and doing business in Oregon. Over the past 10, 15 years, there's been this notion of economic nexus, which steps away from physical presence. But the key takeaway point here is nexus is a yes or no as to whether or not the state can tax a corporation. So if the answer to that is yes, then where does the taxation start? And our starting point is our tie to federal law and its federal taxable income. So if you look at the corporation, what is their federal taxable income? And then the question is, how much of that income does Oregon get to tax? We get to the issue of apportionment. And we are at a single sales factor where that percentage, that ratio, Oregon sales divided by U.S. sales, determines the that ratio is multiplied by federal taxable income to get at Oregon's tax base. And the easiest way to think about Oregon sales is, you know, economists like the widget example. If a company sells widgets, you know, what were your widget sales in Oregon versus the U.S.? And that's the easiest example, and that's what we refer to as tangible personal property. Once we get to issues of services or intangibles, it gets more complicated, and there's some other choices there. And the last point on here are special cases related to apportionment, and these will be industries that are kind of a one-off, and the interstate broadcasters is an example of that. Airlines is another example. There are some companies in some industries that there are different definitions of sales. It gets a little more complicated than the widget example. But those are just a few key terms. So a very brief history or historical context. Prior to 1989, the first statutes that reference interstate broadcasters were put on the books in 1989. So prior to that, they weren't referenced. And during this time period, the state used a method called cost of performance. And this applied to intangibles and services and wasn't a market-based approach in terms of sales in Oregon versus the U.S. All of the Oregon sales were attributed to whatever state had the plurality of production costs. The point being, it wasn't a market-based approach back then. So from 1989 to 2013, we had this audience factor. That's what was put in place in 1989. There was this audience ratio, basically the Oregon audience divided by the U.S. audience. Again, simplifying for the sake of conversation. And then in 2014, House Bill 4138 was passed, and we had this temporary provision that moved away from the audience apportionment method to this, what's referred to as commercial domicile. And basically, the interstate broadcasters just assigned their sales to the headquarters of the company where they had a direct revenue stream, so advertising and licensing. And we're going to get into a little more detail later. But this was a move away from the audience factor. And that's been the core policy that the legislature has been looking at. It was initially put in for 3 years, 14 through 16. It required a report by LRO, so we put that report out. But that what became clear over those 3 years is all of these brewing audits and court cases were questioning what the baseline is for the policy, what current law really said, and what the actual tax was due. And without that baseline, it was hard to say what the deviation from that baseline would be, what the revenue impact would be. We didn't know there was argument about that starting point. So the policy was extended for 2 years and then extended for 1 year. And in 2019, the latest extension, that's where we again got to this report. Rather than waiting on the court system to come up with conclusions, because a number of these cases are still pending, and Kate's going to talk a little bit more about that. We got to this report, and the core issue being, regardless of how those court cases turn out, the legislature has the responsibility, the authority to determine what the tax policy is moving forward. And that's kind of where we are right now. With 2020, under current law, it reverts to the audience method. One thing I wanted to mention in here, I mentioned the cost of performance. In the 2017 session with Senate Bill 28, the state moved away from cost of performance and now has a market-based sourcing as our baseline backdrop. And that'll come back in later in the discussion.
Yes, Representative Roeschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chris, just on the court cases, I'm trying to understand whether the number of court cases has increased because of the change between 2013 and 2014, the audience versus commercial domicile method, and or whether it is that the 2014 law was not clear enough, and so it's caused a lot more court cases.
Rep. Roeschke, Kate's going to go into the court cases in a couple slides. Okay. The vast majority of the court cases are before tax year 2014.
Okay.
They're under the old law.
Thank you.
So some of the questions that for members who have been around the past few sessions, these are the issues that we've been looking at and trying to answer to ultimately provide the best estimate for a revenue impact for whichever policy the legislature would like to consider. And so the first one really is, who is an interstate broadcaster? And so we have part of the definition up here. The definition of broadcasting is here. And the key phrase here is highlighted is any one-way electronic signal. There's also a definition for interstate broadcasting, but that definition relies on broadcasting. So what we have here is broadcasting. And as we've looked at this, the any one-way electronic signal seems to be, at least from our take, is very broad language and could include a lot of companies that people don't necessarily think of broadcasters. Basically, if you can watch something, it's being brought, there is a one-way signal being involved, and then so somehow there's a company that might get caught up into the taxation of the current law structure. So that's just something we have in the back of our mind about how broad this might be, because when we've talked over the past few years about industry, we've been talking to the MPAA. They represent 5 to 7 companies, and the industry might be much broader with the definition that we have in here. And I believe there are still ongoing discussions as to exactly what those parameters are. But just a one-way signal is in today's technology is pretty broad. The second,
Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so just to help me understand again, could a podcast? So somebody does a podcast and they have advertising in that podcast, whether it's audio or whether it's video, does that fit this definition?
I believe that's a good question. I mean, we've raised those kinds of questions.
Okay.
And from when internally within LRO, that seems to fit the definition. Now, that's not LC's opinion. That's not a legal opinion.
Right.
But when we're looking at it, trying to understand the industry and from the taxation perspective, those are the kinds of things that we think about that, well, they might get caught up in this. Now, it would depend on the kind of taxpayer.
Right.
If they're a corporation or not a corporation. I mean, we've talked about YouTube. There are major sports leagues that you can watch games via apps as opposed to just on a regular network. But those are the kinds of questions.
And so just to add something, I'm Caitlin Harger, Legislative Revenue Office. This definition of broadcasting has not been changed since 1989. Other parts of the statute have. I believe the definition of interstate broadcaster has. But if you think about this in a 1989 context, it probably wasn't as broad as it is today.
Right.
But given the changing technology, like Chris said, now it seems like this could be very, very broad.
Thank you.
Pre-internet versus post-internet.
Yes.
The second question is, how much of the broadcaster's income is subject to apportionment? Because the way the statute reads is that if you are an interstate broadcaster, then all of your income falls into this apportionment method. And what we've learned from the Comcast case is that it is all income other than revenue from tangible personal property or real property. And so depending on the nature of the business and we're talking consolidated returns, I could have various revenue streams, is that all of that would be subject to this apportionment as opposed to just the broadcasting revenue. And the third item here is one of those sensitive areas that we've talked about. It is an issue in terms of understanding the taxation, and that is what gives a company nexus or economic nexus. And you're going to hear from Kate on, I think, the next slide. This has been a key topic or a point of contention in the court cases that are pre-2014. Some of the different opinions here, and there are a lot of different opinions here, is that one opinion is that economic nexus has been the law for a long time, and that's how DOR has applied it. And economic nexus is basically a company that is benefiting from Oregon's economy has nexus and then is subject to taxation. So it's not a physical presence concept. It's just the company's benefiting from Oregon's economy that creates economic nexus, and the state can tax them. There was the Wayfair decision last year in 2018. Some people feel that has had an effect on nexus, and other people don't. So this is just one of the issues that is relevant to understanding who is subject to taxation. It's really, whether or not the state can tax you, but there is a chance for confusion here. And depending on who you talk to, the timing, the tax year that you're talking about is irrelevant. So.
All right. So again, I'm Caitlin Harger from the Legislative Revenue Office. I'll be talking a little bit about the current court cases. We wanted to provide some context of these cases, given that they've been going on for a long time and have been part of this discussion. But the vast majority of them are in tax years pre-2014 change. I believe there's only one tax year out of 31 tax years that is in 2015, for example. So again, this is the goal is to kind of provide context here, but these aren't issues that are being raised in later tax years currently, to refresh Kay's question earlier. So the tax years range from 2006 to 2015. We wanted to talk a little bit about the process. So typically, this starts with the Department of Revenue. If a taxpayer in the Department of Revenue disagree about how much is due, they have their own internal process. If the taxpayer then chooses to contest that process, it goes to the Magistrate Division of the Tax Court. Again, if that decision is appealed, it will go to the regular division of a tax court. And then again, if that decision is appealed, we go to the Supreme Court. And so in general, that's how this process works. So part of the reason that these cases have taken so long to get through the legal system is this process. Additionally, when the Comcast case was moving through the court system, a number of the ongoing cases were put on hold because of the overlap of issues. So while Comcast was making progress through the system, the other cases weren't necessarily moving along at the same time. So that's kind of the context of why is this taking so long. I've made a table here that highlights some of the main issues, and the frequency column refers to out of the seven ongoing cases that we're aware of, this is the number of cases in which this question or issue arises. So one is the company an interstate broadcaster? As Chris mentioned earlier, am I engaging in profit-seeking behavior within Oregon using this one-way signal? Second, does the company have nexus? So does Oregon have a right to tax me as a company? And Chris described, I think, accurately this difference between physical presence and economic nexus. Third, do apportionment provisions for broadcasters apply to all revenue sources? This is what the Comcast case dealt with. So in the case of Comcast, the court ruled that they did apply to all revenue sources. However, kind of our understanding is that all these cases are so fact specific that this is a concept that in three other cases is still ongoing or potentially still an issue. And then finally, determination of the audience factor. So that apportionment factor, there are disagreements in these cases between the Department of Revenue and industry as to how that's being calculated and whether it accurately represents their audience. And so that shows up in three out of the seven cases. And again, for the timing, I do just want to mention again, vast majority of these cases are pre-2014, and there's 31 tax years across these seven cases. And so now, as Chris mentioned, we wanted to provide kind of a simplified overview of what the industry looks like today. As we described in 1989, it was very different than it is today. So we've been thinking about this kind of in three stages of production for these types of companies. So we have content production first, then distribution. So I make content, how do I distribute it? And then the end user being the viewer. So under content production, which is this first column, there are kind of three broad categories we've been considering. The first is a national network. This is what used to be referred to as a broadcaster. So this is like NBC, ABC, Fox, and CBS. So those are national networks. Cable networks are the other channels that you're familiar with that are typically only accessed through a cable subscription. Whereas with national networks with an antenna, you could potentially access these. And then direct to consumer are these kind of newer types of services that are starting up. So things like Netflix, Hulu, Amazon Prime, obviously Disney Plus launched recently. So any type of direct to consumer method. And so at the content production stage, these companies are licensing content to distributors or providing it via subscription to direct consumers. And they are receiving money in return, license fees or direct subscriptions. So then when we get to the distribution stage, there are kind of four broad categories. There's cable, so something like Comcast, satellite, something like Dish or DirecTV, telecom, this would be AT&T or Verizon, And then internet is, so for example, if I was Netflix, but I am an internet distributing content that wasn't made in-house, then I would fall into this category. And so in the distribution side, distribution of content and local ads are occurring if their ads as part of their business model. And then viewers are sending subscription fees back to these distributors. So we're seeing kind of this three-tiered process.
Representative Reschke.
I'm going to run out of questions, but thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I don't think so.
So you mentioned there, Caitlin, about two different models. One is through a distribution, and one is direct end user. But Netflix could actually fit both, as you said, because Netflix or companies like them will rebroadcast something that's been produced by somebody else, but they'll also create their own unique content, and so they don't have that distribution fee. Is that correct? Am I understanding that?
Yes. Faith, it's in Rep. Reschke. That is exactly correct. And what we found going through this industry research is that a lot of these questions came up in our discussions, and they seem to be very company specific. Mm-hmm. If you think of something like HBO, I think it's HBO Now, mm-hmm. Where they're only, but actually, and even in that case, there are movies that they broadcast. And right. So often it's kind of a mix of these. In addition to like even Netflix versus Hulu, Netflix doesn't have advertisements as part of their service. Hulu does. So even though those are pretty similar, there are all these smaller differences. So yes, you're exactly correct. Okay. And so then the end user would be the viewer here. And so that's the industry currently. And where we believe, and I think there's kind of general agreement about this, the industry is going in the future, is to more of this direct-to-consumer, cutting out the distributor. So a lot fewer people are subscribing to cable or satellite traditional TV production. Now they're buying multiple subscriptions to things like Netflix and Hulu and Plus. So one thing that we're finding that it seems like will continue in the future is this idea that these subscriptions are demographic driven. So for example, if you think about Netflix, especially when it initially launched or in previous years, the audience that it's tailoring to is very broad, right? You can watch everything from Seinfeld, I think Seinfeld's on Netflix, Frasier, to Stranger Things. So there's this kind of broad demographic. Whereas now we see things like Disney Plus, which tends to be a narrower demographic potentially. So it seems like a lot of these direct-to-consumer markets are becoming really demographic driven in terms of who they're targeting. And then we've also talked about the possibility that, you know, several years down the road, we might see industry consolidation again. So right now, I have a subscription to HBO Now, to Netflix, to Hulu. If I got Disney Plus, that's a lot of individual subscriptions, and so you could see potential for a market opening of someone to say, wow, wouldn't it be great if I had one bill and I could watch all of these things that I want, just like you can now with Comcast. So in terms of how the industry is changing, we think it might kind of ebb and flow in these terms, but for right now, we're thinking of this in terms of kind of three chunks of distribution or three chunks of production for these types of companies.
So that takes it, the bottom line is, what would a tax policy look like moving forward? What will be put before you? What will you consider in 2020? And to start off with the easy ones, one, you could just return to audience factor. So, and that one is actually current law. If no bill passes, then we revert to the audience factor with the definition of interstate broadcaster and all of their income being in that pot. It's kind of a, meaning you're an interstate broadcaster, then all of your income gets apportioned that way. Two, you could maintain the commercial domicile. That's what's been in place since 2014. That could continue. It could be extended for some finite number of years, or it could be made permanent. The third one listed here is market-based sourcing. And a potential way to get here would be to remove the interstate broadcasting and the broadcasting provisions from statute. And part of our thinking about that is to the point that Kate was just making, forward thinking about the industry. Even, I can't tell you how many times we got tied up in the language of interstate broadcaster and how that's old language. And moving forward, what we're really talking about are the content creators or content production, you know, the content creator, and then how it gets to the viewer, whether there's an end run around the distribution or if that's part of it. And that's where the industry seems to be going. So to the extent possible, it would be advisable to have the tax policy lining up with the future rather than just looking to the past. Now, market-based sourcing, there's a good news, bad news potential here as we've talked to stakeholders about it. Conceptually, they like the concept, but then we get to, well, what is the meaning of market? And that's where there's still a lot of contention. To the extent we understand industry's perspective, and this is kind of I think they will argue that the commercial domicile is the market-based approach, that their direct streams of revenue are their market, and that is reflected through commercial domicile. On the other side, it gets at this notion that the companies, all of these shows, if Oregonians are watching the show, then the company, the broadcaster, if you will, the content creator, is benefiting from Oregon eyeballs watching that show. And this is where we're kind of, you have two sides there. One, that the domicile is it. And so in some ways, the good news is that the market-based sourcing might be a way to move forward. The bad news is, I don't know if we're just restating the question as to audience or domicile. So we're still kind of working through that right now. And part of that conversation is maybe we're trying to find a path forward, and maybe there's a way to differentiate across the revenue streams. And so there are the three primary revenue streams for these folks. They have licensing, they have advertising, and then they have the subscriptions. So starting with the subscriptions, there's no reason to apportion that. They know where we live. If you have a subscription, if you're an Oregonian, then those sales can be just allocated to Oregon. There's no need to apportion that. Licensing, similarly, the programming is being licensed to a company, and maybe it's licensed to the local TV stations in Portland, so maybe those are attributable to Oregon. And then we get into questions of where Comcast is headquartered and DirecTV and Dish. And the third one is advertising, and maybe that one can be done by audience as opposed to assigning them somewhere. There might be different ways to apportion these different revenue streams. And that's really the theme here, is rather than viewing it as all of the revenue has to be apportioned this way, well, maybe there's a path forward where we look at the different revenue streams and maybe some sort of apportionment method. The best apportionment method depends on the revenue stream that we're talking about. So that's kind of where we are right now, and a glimpse into the report. At least we're still finalizing the report and still writing the report, but this is where we are as of this morning.
I have two questions for you. One is, it seems that even though we're interested to follow the court cases, and it may clarify or make some decisions about some things, that's about the past. And it seems as though it is possible for the Oregon legislature to make a decision about what we want our tax policy to be, regardless of how the court cases come out. It may help inform how we would want to write a tax law to get it right, but it's not going to preclude us from making a decision, choosing, for example, one method versus another.
Correct. I think that's correct in that the court decisions could help inform the policymaking for the future. I don't know. I don't view the committee or the legislature as being bound when debating taxable income for a given company is divided somehow among the 50 states. And I'm just using 50, if we assume they all have an income tax. And that at a state level taxation, 100% exactly, not less and not more, of their income, of their federal taxable income, is taxed by the states. And that's the issue of apportionment. And every state has enough quirks. So if every state had a single sales factor or a three factor formula, it would be, all states had the same method of taxation, then we could get to that 100% pretty easily. As you know, the states don't. So one of the concerns is, in some cases, if taxpayers are being taxed on more than 100%, but There's also concern about what gets referred to as nowhere income, is that doesn't get taxed by states. Now, states have the authority to make their own, the state legislatures have their own authority to make the policies on how they want to tax companies or not. So part of it is, so that, to provide a theoretical answer, mm-hmm. we can get at some of those pieces.
Yeah, thank you. Are there any other questions on this agenda item? Well, thank you. Thank you. Let's move now to the second agenda item. Department of Revenue.
All right, good morning. For the record, I'm Deanna Mack with Department of Revenue, and I'm here to talk about using data for tax compliance in our new system. So some of you are new to the committee, so I thought I'd go a little bit over our background. I know Representative Smith is very familiar with our core system replacement project, but for years, our department had a system that was based, it was written in COBOL language that we had built ourselves. And as time passed, fewer and fewer people were able to program in that system, in that language, and our system was approaching 30 years of age. So because of the potential risk for failure and the importance of the systems that we use, we began developing a business plan back in April of 2009 to replace all our disparate systems with one return, one system for return processing, audit collections, and accounting that's all integrated. So we completed that process in 2012, and we presented to the 2013 legislature for the our case for replacing that system. And the legislature, that legislature did approve the funding on the last day of session, so we were able to begin that project in July of 2013. We used a phased-in approach to implementing over 4 years. The first programs to convert from our old system to the new system were corporate tax and cigarette and tobacco taxes. We wanted to begin with the small and mid-sized programs first to minimize risk and potential impact to taxpayers in the general fund and other funds. They were a mix of those programs. We successfully converted those programs in November 2014. Next, our largest program, you can tell from the timeline, was our personal income tax program and other programs that affected individuals, which we successfully implemented in December of 2015. Our third rollout went live in November of 2016 and included our largest business tax programs, such as the payroll tax programs, and then our final rollout was complete in November of 2017. Our old systems had much the same functionality. They processed money or processed returns, banked money, issued collection notices, etc., but they were all separate systems. Staff had to jump between systems to access information about a single taxpayer to do their work. Now the system is integrated, so our collectors can see the basis of, for example, the basis of the debt they are collecting, like if it's self-assessed versus enforced compliance, which helps the taxpayers understand why they're engaging with us. We know when we are talking to a person what business they're connected to. The old systems didn't easily connect those dots for us. And this integrated system helps us serve taxpayers more effectively when they need our help because we have a better and more holistic picture of their situation. The new system has a data warehouse where we're able to manage all the data we had from disparate sources in one place. It's a centralized repository of data from multiple external third-party sources like IRS, DMV, wage information, death records from Social Security, and financial institution data match, among others, that's integrated into our system and analytics. This allows us to automate many of our business processes that used to be manual because now we do not need staff to go out and find the information from various sources. It's all, we can use our system to do that. With our discovery system and the information in the data warehouse, we can identify non-filers and cases that should be audited based on criteria that we program. Because all the data is managed well, the new system will allow us to use scoring methods to identify the level of interaction we need to take with a taxpayer, particularly in our collections function. As time passes and more data is in our new system, is in our new system, I think I might, that is native or original to the system that is not converted data, we will only improve the use of scoring to manage our workload. The new system replaced our inventory management system. Yes, we actually did have inventory. It was paper returns, and there was shelves and shelves and shelves of them. So now, in the old days, they were all paper. Now we have to manage them with a document control numbering system, and that we physically had to stamp on every single piece of paper. Now most of the returns are filed electronically, and it's much easier to manage that inventory with our new system. Our audit and collection functions are entirely electronic in the system now, so that gives us much less paper than we previously had. Gone are the days of us having to put together audit reports and tracing, you know, the work papers from one page to another that came with the old system. Management now can review all of the work of their subordinates completely in the system itself. Finally, this new system has given us a better real-time view of operational metrics and reports that help us effectively manage and respond to the immediate workload by reassigning resources or adjusting thresholds. Oregon has a voluntary compliance system. So nearly 95% of Oregon taxpayers file and pay as they are supposed to. Voluntary compliance is key to the effective operation of a tax system. We recognize the importance of voluntary compliance systems, so we take a balanced approach to enforcement, education, and assistance. Education and assistance are key to allowing compliant taxpayers to interact with us in a meaningful way. To that end, we provide assistance by making as many self-service options available as possible. We have call centers that help taxpayers when they call us if they can't find answers online or need assistance. We give educational training to the practitioner community so they are well-versed in how they assist our clients in filing. And every year we update our forms and instructions in easy, simple to use, simple to understand terms so that folks can comply. We also provide guidance to our administrative rules process. But the department's strategy for allocating resources focus on two outcome areas, the voluntary compliance and enforced compliance. However, this presentation is going to talk more about enforced compliance and how we use data to perform that function. I just wanted you to be aware of the other ways we look at taxpayer compliance. So enforced compliance includes areas listed on the slide, return processing, audit, filing enforcement, and collections. Automation does take some time and must be implemented thoughtfully. When we automate our business processes, we need to be sure that all areas of the department and with taxpayers as well are able to handle the downstream impacts of automation. There's going to be an increased call volume from notices. There's more appeals. Taxpayers may have to handle more garnishment challenges, or banks might have to handle more garnishments if we automate fully. So we're mindful of all those things. Aspect of using the automated or of automating business processes is that the data we are using to drive the business processes should be native to our new system and not converted data from our old system converted in. This takes time to build as taxpayers file returns year after year, which means the tools we use for enforcement will only get better with time.
Deanna, yes. Excuse me, I'm going to interrupt you. Mm-hmm. Could you please expand on a little more on native versus converted data?
Okay.
It's jargon.
Right. Madam Chair, sure. Converted data is the data that we had in our old system, and we moved it into our new system. And so what we call native data is when a person files a return and the data is only in our new system. It was never in our old system. So it's native to that original, to the new system that we're using. And so there's more confidence in non-converted data, if that makes sense.
And why is there more confidence in it?
Well, because you're transferring between two systems, Madam Chair.
So is that because in transferring it using an automated system, the system itself was assigning categories or tags, or how, in other words, errors are introduced or inconsistencies are introduced somehow, either manually or from an automated system?
Madam Chair, I'm not an IT expert, but as far as I know, that's pretty standard practice in the IT world, that they there's a little bit less confidence in converted data, but I can find out the answer. I don't know off the top of my head, but it's that's the difference between
converted and native. I'd like to hear about it at a future time.
Native. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
And that was my question, is what confidence or what percent of the data is corrupted data by moving it from one platform to the other?
Madam Chair and Representative Finley, my understanding, and this is what I've been told from the project, is that they were able to balance. I mean, they were very, very careful, and they balanced the transactions that they converted to the penny, is what I'd been told. So I don't know that there was any in actuality, but that is a caution that they use as they're working with data, if that makes sense.
Great.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Okay, so we're on slide 6 now, automation using data. So we do use data to automate many of our processes. Our return processing system does how we identify audits, which audits to undertake and which taxpayers aren't filing. We also plan to use the data to automate some of our collection functions that are authorized in statute, such as issuing notices of garnishment and write-off and cancellation if the debtor account meets the statutory requirements. I do believe we actually have implemented write-off, and we're working on the other two. We can also score a taxpayer based on that taxpayer-specific behavior to identify whether we need to engage with them or whether they will self-resolve without interaction with the department. So system edits are created based on data from prior year experiences. We analyze where taxpayers are making errors through audits and other adjustments using our system data, and we update the system each year to reflect those areas. If an edit, what we call an edit, it's something that we look for in the return stops, and a people's eyes actually look at it, or we can clear it in an automated way because it passed the edit. If an edit that we expect to be productive in 1 year ends up not being productive, we can change that edit. So if we say we think we should look at taxpayers are making this error a lot, and then they end up not making that error, we'll clear that edit because it's not an issue anymore. And vice versa, if we find that taxpayers are making this error over and over again, then we'll keep that edit because it was productive, because we're fixing their returns and making them correct. This allows us to catch simple errors, such as a statutory limit that was exceeded during return processing, which means that we can correct the minor errors efficiently. So one of the most common ones is a federal tax subtraction. You'll see it's got a flat limit. And if someone says, you know, I think it's like, say, $6,500, I can't remember exactly what it is this year, and they claim $8,000, we can just automatically fix it to $6,500 based on the data that we use in our system. Beyond that, we program many rules into our return processing system to align with current and new law so that the return processing is accurate and we have confidence in the refunds that we're issuing. So,
Representative Finley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a quick question. Mm-hmm. What's the time frame and the spin up from rules to programming? So an example on new tax programs or major changes to the tax code, mm-hmm. that the rules have to be written and put in place, and then the spin up into the software to deal with that. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking specifically about the CAT program.
I know you are, Madam Chair and Representative Finley. So I'm not prepared to give an update on that, but generally there are two different kinds of rules. There's administrative rules, and then there's business rules. And business rules are what people use to code into the system that says, if this, then that happens. And so we have a series, we use data to make that happen. Administrative rules can be done in a very short period of time. They can be done in a very lengthy period of time, depending on the complexity of the rule. And generally, not everything needs to be adopted in an administrative rule in order for us to write business rules. Like, for example, if a return is annual or a return is quarterly, we can write business rules in our system to do that, and we share that with vendors so they have the ability to do that as well. But it varies depending on the program, varies depending on implementation timelines. And again, they're different rules. Okay, is that good?
It's good, thank
you. Okay, so I think we're
I would very much like to have a CAT discussion at some point. Today's not the day.
Thank you. Okay, so one of the other areas, we're on slide 8 now, is tax refund fraud. We have got they've gotten more sophisticated through the years, and it's a national problem. It's not just unique to Oregon. It used to be that we would see people alter W-2s to show more withholding, for example, but now we see entire identities stolen and W-2 information from real taxpayers from around the country. In 2013, we asked the legislature for funding to improve our fraud analytics to help prevent taxpayer refunds from getting into the hands of what we call fraudsters. While this has improved our ability to stop fraudulent refunds from going out the door, sometimes your constituents will have their returns slowed while we check to make sure those sophisticated thieves have not stolen the real taxpayer's identity. So I understand it can be frustrating for some folks as they have to submit documentation to prove they are the real taxpayer, but we do this to ensure that the refund they have claimed gets to them and not to the fraudsters. So to assist with fraud protection, we also approached the legislature with a funding request to allow our sister agency, the Employment Department, to capture state withholding data from employer when it filed its payroll returns. This information allows us now to verify withholding that was reported by a third party, the employer, to the withholding that's reported on the individual's tax return in real time. So as a result of this improvement, we began to issue refunds in mid-February, since the filing due date for the fourth quarter payroll tax return is January 31st. That gives us about 2 weeks to process the fourth quarter data so that we can compare in real time against information that they're filing on their returns. So that's another use of data. And then finally, as part in the 2019 legislative session, the legislature passed opened up our disclosure statutes to allow us to work with the IRS and other states in preventing refund fraud nationally. Again, this is a national problem, and what the states see is they see other taxpayers in other states filing returns in Oregon, so they're often first-time filers, and this helps sharing this data with these states and receiving data from them helps us with our analytics as well. We also do filing enforcement. Filing enforcement is when we have information from a third party that a person, a taxpayer, has a filing requirement, but they have not filed a return, right? We can tell that from our system. So in our old system, it was mostly a manual process. We would have staff check each of those third-party systems that we talked to you about earlier, DMV, employment, all those things, to see if there were sources, if they're a resident, that kind of stuff. They had to do that manually before they could issue the letter series that would then encourage folks to file on their own. If they didn't, then we would assess tax based on the best information available to us. Pretty much each step in that process was manual until we converted into our new system. Now we've been able to automate this process for our personal income tax and withholding tax programs. This means we're able to free up staff to work on other emergent issues such as refund fraud, where we, as we saw an increase in workload there because of the improvements in data, implemented smarter data analytics to combat fraud. So a lot of times we moved people from one area to another. Our audits, although we consider audits a form of enforced compliance, the overall goal of our audit program is to increase voluntary compliance through enforcement efforts. So, you know, when you hear your neighbors being audited, it kind of makes you a little bit nervous to maybe try it on your return. So we balance complex and single issue audits so that we ensure that we have an in-depth and widespread impact on Oregon's tax base. In our old system, we could identify one issue on a return, potential issue on a return. We did use SQL. We used SQL to do that, so it was somewhat automated. But the new system allows us to identify multiple issues on the return before creating the audit lead that will be assigned to an auditor. This allows us to assign returns that have more potential for error than we could in the past, because we can identify most of the issues. Strategically allocating our audit resources in this manner also allows us to have a presence throughout the state, from individual taxpayers to out-of-state corporations with an Oregon filing requirement. So using our data, we've identified 5 major risk areas to non-compliance that we apply in our audit function. And some of you may be aware that there's more non-compliance in business reporting than there is in individual reporting, although we do actually audit all all types. They are generally where we see more noncompliance is with sole proprietorships, pass-through entities, including partnerships, S-corporations and domestic C-corporations, multi-state corporations, and multinational corporations. It's not as much third-party reporting in those areas as there are in individual taxpayers. Through our centralized case selection process, though, a team develops queries to select audit cases that address current risk areas, again, based on data. However, in the past, much of this work has been manual. So the tools we can now use in our new system help allow us to improve our querying abilities and more efficiently evaluate the effectiveness of the queries and the subsequent audits. Our collection system, this is a functional area that is a critical one and has been the focus of legislative improvement over the last several years. Because every year, new debt is added, right? Because there's a new return filed by a taxpayer, potentially even every quarter, depending on the program. That creates the opportunity for our accounts receivables to increase. So we're continually looking for ways to improve our work and enforced collections. In our old system, we had automated as many functions as we could, but much of the work was still manual. For example, a distrait warrant is an essential part of the collection process that is a legal document required to be issued before we can do any collections to seize anything from anyone. This means that a distrait warrant had to be issued before we could issue a garnishment. In some cases, our old system didn't automatically get a warrant issued for whatever reason. That meant when we identified a garnishment source, we had to check to make sure a warrant had been issued, and now we don't have to do that. In our new system, all our required collection notices, or what we call Dunning letters, what industry calls Dunning letters, are automated now. This means that when we identify a garnishment source using the data we have in our data warehouse, we are ready and able to issue the garnishment and do not have to wait for a distrait warrant to be issued. Of course, the distrait warrant is all based on data. We issue them based on data because there's criteria in our system that says that this is eligible now for a distrait warrant to be issued. So we've already automated our write-off process, and we're in the process of automating our garnishment and cancellation processes here in the near future. By automating these processes, we keep the accounts receivable balances healthier, and as they shouldn't get stale, you know, because there's old debt that's sitting on there that's uncollectible. Automating the garnishment process, though, we're using very strict business rules that will allow us to get payments more effectively than we could have from a manual review that takes much more time. Automation also allows us to have our collectors focus more time on assisting our customers with setting up payment plans, answering questions, or making collection calls, and less time on routine tasks that are low risk and easy to automate. So beyond the data that we use for tax compliance, we also use data for our system to manage our day-to-day operations. We have performance measures that we need to determine that we determine how well we're doing. And that includes areas like how many returns we process, how long does it take to issue a refund, call wait times, among some of the other things listed on the slide. By using data for enforcement, we also have other goals beyond using data for enforcement. I'm sorry, I'm not feeling that well today. We also have other goals to maximize compliance that include several items. The legislature recently approved a consolidation process for our collections function, each collections unit was previously scattered in the division, if it was individual versus business versus special program. Centralized collections, we expect, should give us a centralized management strategy as well as a better understanding and accountability of our collection function, so our data will get better there as well. We have a talented group of people working for us, and that often means that we leave vacancies behind. So one of our goals here is to fully reach and maintain fully staffing. So we're committed to doing that so that our workload is well managed and taxpayers have the resources they need to comply with the tax laws of Oregon. To that end, we have goals in place that require staff to be trained in various areas, including developing their knowledge of a new system. Change is always hard, especially when you're used to doing your work one way and you have to learn how to do it another way because of a major system overhaul. So we've provided a lot of training to get people on board with that. And as we work in our new system, we are identifying and streamlining processes to maximize workflows and adopt national best practices. Finally, as I started at the beginning, the department's focus is on two outcome areas, right? Voluntary compliance and enforced compliance. So we take a balanced approach to that, so because we recognize the importance of giving the people the tools that they need to easily comply with the law, and the need for enforcement to ensure people do it accurately and timely. And just to thank you guys, the legislature has helped us over the years in getting more data in our system so that we are more effective at what we do. Most recently in 2017, you passed financial institution data match, which allows us to identify clearly what financial institutions a debtor is banking at. Rather, we used to send out 6 or 7 garnishments to 6 or 7 different institutions. Now we just send it to the one because we know where the bank is. And that's all based on data. That was a streamlined process improvement because of the data you helped us provide. Same thing with employer new hire reporting. It used to take months for us to know when someone was hired in a new job to be able to issue a garnishment. This report allows us to know in a matter of days. So that is also a data improvement that helped us. And then finally, in 2019, I think I mentioned this earlier, you shared, I opened our disclosure statutes to allow us to share as part of the IRS's Security Summit in what they call ISAC, the Information Sharing and Analysis Center. And that, again, helps combat fraud. So I hope this information has been helpful for you to understand how we use data in tax compliance. And it's kind of all over the board. It's operational metrics, it's tax compliance, enforced compliance. But if you have any questions, I'm happy to try and answer them.
100%. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Deanna, for that report. Really interesting, and clearly made a lot of progress. And I'm channeling Representative Gomberg here, who's always wondering how we can support the department to give you the workforce needed to go after all the uncollected debt. So I wonder if you could just say uncollected revenue. I wonder if you could say something about, it seems like you must have made a lot of progress. We didn't hear overall numbers in terms of percentage or dollars, what direction that's going. I assume that you're collecting a lot more from this report, but can you just say something overall about the need that remains?
The need that remains
to collect uncollected revenue.
So
given that you've made a lot of progress here, but we keep hearing that there's still a lot of uncollected.
Madam Chair and Representative Kenny Geyer, one of the things that we try to have folks understand about the nature of tax debt, and you're right, you see the news articles, they're really flashy, $3-some-odd billion of debt. Most of that is other fund. Most of that is not owed the state. It's mostly criminal judgments that is probably not very collectible, so it looks quite inflated. But we do have about $800 million, plus or minus, I haven't looked at the number lately, in general fund debt. And about every tax year, we have about $300 million that gets added, and we collect about that same amount every year. So we try to, it's called the churn in the accounts receivable. There's more taxpayers coming to Oregon. We have over 4 million people in Oregon now, and that's going to cause our accounts receivable to grow. And then just if we're in a downturn of an economy, people tend to not pay their debt. They change their withholding, or they do other things to avoid paying. So I actually have my collection division administrator here today to talk, if you want to talk to her about the collections functions more specifically. But we're aware of that. It's a priority for us. And we do our darndest. We're trying to get as many data sources as we can. I know that Senator Johnson just put through a bill that allows us to post delinquent debtors online that we're implementing right now. I mean, we're still in the process of consolidating our collections function. So I think that we're automating, like I said, garnishment processes. We're working with business. We're working with financial institutions on that because they'll have a workload as well with that, among other things. So I don't know that there's anything identifiable right now that we need. We've got a lot of tools that you've already given us, and there's still some that we're still implementing that we haven't had a chance to finish implementing, if that makes sense.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to share with the committee, the Department of Revenue over the last 2, 3, 4 years has really gone under a lot of review from the legislature, and I'm pleased to report to you that, in my view, they're doing a phenomenal job. The director took on some challenges that
normal directors don't step into. And she's done a great job working with the legislature and with other partners. One of the areas where I know this to be true is when you talk with the CPA community. Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, boy, it was pretty rough. Now when you visit with local CPAs, you'll hear a much different tone. Mm-hmm. And so my compliments for all the work you've done. On the collection issue, just very briefly, I think you did an excellent job summarizing it. Every 2 years, we take a look at collections in the General Government Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and the vast majority of those dollars are uncollectible. At some point, the legislature is going to have to ask itself, do you just write it off? What do you do with this? Because, you know, when someone owes the state $1 million, but they're also serving 30 years in the Department of Corrections, it's pretty hard to get that money. And so the department sits there with this large receivable where everyone tends to critique. But when you really dig down a little bit, there's a logic as to why it is what it is. So thank you.
We'll now move to the final agenda item, update on tax expenditure definition report.
Okay, Madam Chair. So I'm having a technological fail here.
Oh, okay.
So there, the next item is the tax expenditure definition discussion. There are two items in OLIS. One is, it's called Identifying Tax Expenditures. That's a two-page document taken from the Department of Revenue. It's just there for your reading later. It goes into more detail about what John, you have in front of you, John Hart from the Department of Revenue. He's a senior economist in the research section. He's he works on the report, so he's gonna be talking about the DOR's role in this. So what I wanted to do is get into the document called Tax Expenditure Definition. And the goal for this discussion here is just to get the entire committee on the same page that there is a problem related to a confluence of the definition of a tax expenditure and these automatic sunsets. Mm-hmm. As you may recall from the 2019 session, so if you can go to the next page, Corinne. In the 2019 session, House Bill 2128 requires a report to be produced between DOR and LRO. And I have the main language up there. It's to study the statutory definition of tax expenditures and the operation of the automatic sunset provisions applied to those. And there were a couple of informational hearings during the session on the issue. And so that's what the report requires. If we go back in time a little bit on the next slide, we go back to the creation of the tax expenditure report in 1995. And I think John's going to elaborate on this a little bit. After I kind of set up the discussion here, is it's any law of the federal government or the state that exempts in whole or in part people or income from the impact of established taxes. That definition of established taxes is kind of a key sticking point on exactly what that means. So that was the report created in the requirement of the report in 1995. And since then, the DOR has been producing the report and it accompanies the governor's budget. Technically, it's the governor's tax expenditure report. DOR is the entity that produces it. So on the next slide, we get back into some of the subsequent legislation. And the key part here is highlighted here in this third definition. And this provision in the ORS are the automatic sunsets. And number two relates to tax credits. That's pretty clear as to what a tax credit is. But the third one is this automatic sunset for any tax expenditure. And so if we go to the next slide, it highlights the confluence here. Two key things that aren't identified in statute, or maybe it's one thing said two different ways, is who determines if a given policy is a tax expenditure. The statute simply says that any tax expenditure, unless the legislature says otherwise, has an automatic sunset. So that's what we refer to as implicit sunsets. So, but the statute doesn't identify who gets to make that decision. Stated another way, there's this distinction between whether a policy is part of a tax base or a tax expenditure. And I think John has a really clear example of that gets at, I'm trying not to say the word highlights, that gets at that issue. But, and then I think the next slide baskets. I'm going to hand it over to John. He's really here to help answer questions and provide information to the committee about DOR's role and some of the challenges that they have. They have the responsibility to produce the report. And so there are some challenges responding to statute.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Hart. I'm an economist in the research section at the Oregon Department of Revenue. We do produce the tax expenditure report, and until recently, the definition of tax expenditure was used solely in the production of that report. So there was not a lot of consequence if we included something in the report that shouldn't be there, or if we excluded something that should be there. We try to be over-inclusive, so we try to include things that may be tax expenditures but probably aren't. And occasionally, we actually find that we have missed things that were real tax expenditures that snuck through another committee while we were paying attention to the revenue committees. The difficulty when you use the definition for both the sunsets and inclusion in the report is the definition itself, and I'll pop back here to it. The definition itself says that we're exempting in whole or in part from the impact of established taxes. And what the established tax is a very subjective issue. So the examples that I borrowed from Deanna Mack, haven't discussed these in detail with her, kind of get at this. Example two is actually pretty easy. Example two, if a tax was placed on yellow highlighters only, is the established tax a tax on all highlighters that excludes non-yellow highlighters, or is the established tax a tax just on yellow highlighters with no exclusions? And at that point, it's pretty subjective. The first example, I was trying to think of a way to make a exemption for blue highlighters if all highlighters are taxed, something that might not be a tax expenditure. And the best thing I came up with, and this is not true as far as I know, is that maybe a tax was placed on all highlighters because exposing your skin to highlighter ink was causing medical issues. And we found out in a subsequent session that blue highlighters weren't doing that. And so maybe the established tax is a tax on highlighters that are causing medical issues, and the exemption for blue highlighters would not be a tax expenditure. And maybe it would be, depending on kind of the subjective view of the audience. On the other hand, if blue highlighters were exempt because it's somebody's favorite color, that's very clearly a tax expenditure. But in both of these cases, it's kind of in the eye of the beholder if what you're looking at is a tax expenditure. And the subjective nature is such that we've given a lot of thought to what words might be used to make an objective definition. And I have not found a set of rules that would work in every case that would identify only things that any person would think was a tax expenditure and would not misidentify things that same person didn't think was a tax expenditure. And so we're left having this automatic sunset, and Deanna talked earlier about kind of using caution and automating processes, but we have this automatic sunset provision that leaves taxpayers, practitioners, and the department in a place where we don't actually know what the tax law is because it's subjective. And we can maybe write a rule that says this is a tax expenditure, but it has to kind of be brought to the department's attention to even think about whether something is a tax expenditure. The bicycle tax contains a real life example, because the bicycle tax said that a bicycle was anything on wheels that was used for propelling a person. And then it said durable medical equipment is not a bicycle. And I don't think anyone would have argued that the bicycle tax was intended to apply to wheelchairs, but the plain language suggests that there's an exemption for wheelchairs, and whether that's part of the tax base, part of the established tax, or whether it's kind of an exemption from the established tax is in the eye of the beholder, but the plain language makes it look as if it is. And so we just, as we move forward, we're thinking of just being more clear in the report, that's research's responsibility, that if we include something, if you look at the current report, you can actually see places where we say, we're not sure if this meets the definition of a tax expenditure, so we don't know if it has a sunset. Moving forward, we're probably going to, if the law stays as is, we're probably going to kind of make that bifurcation maybe a little wider, because we will want to include things that some people don't think meet the definition or that a lawyer wouldn't think meets the definition. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions or provide more colorful examples.
Senator Reschke.
Thank you. Thank you, John and Chris. I guess as a Republican, I think that red highlighters should also be tax exempt. But so the whether something's not taxable or it's a tax expenditure, as far as revenue, does that have any impact? And then second of all, is this problem more for you to produce your book to define something as a tax expenditure as opposed to it's not being taxed at all?
Madam Chair, Representative Reschke, the difference in whether it meets the definition of a tax expenditure or whether it was intended to be exempt, I can't think of a place where that would affect the revenue at all.
Okay.
It's purely semantic. I don't think that there's an awkwardness that we have if we include something in the book that doesn't meet the definition of a tax expenditure. But we can right now in the sunset line, we can say this does not meet the definition of a tax expenditure, and so it doesn't have a sunset. That makes it more awkward for sure. But the taxpayers themselves, if we're putting something in the book like we did that says we don't know if this has a sunset, mm-hmm. that's super awkward for the taxpayers and difficult.
So just a follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. So this problem has occurred because we have this automated sunset. Before the automated sunset, this wasn't an issue because you didn't know if a new law was created, whether you need to put it in or not. Is that the crux of the matter, or?
Madam Chair, Representative Reschke, the consequence of being wrong was much lower when there wasn't an automated sunset.
Okay.
And so a long time ago, when Representative Butler was chair here, I told him that we agonize over what to put in the book. And agonizing over it doesn't have a lot of consequences. The taxpayers, on the other hand, if they don't know if something has a sunset, that has a consequence.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions?
I think the consequence is really the key point now.
Yeah.
And as there's a report that's not due until 2021, but in conversations, and this has been an ongoing issue, what's partly missing, I think, from statute right now is who gets to decide if it's a tax expenditure.
And is there a process then to?
Right, one way moving forward, I don't want to jump to conclusions, but as we've had a lot of conversations, and that's kind of where I am right now, is that it doesn't identify who. Now, ostensibly, that would be the legislature. That is the policymaking branch. And having this discussion of whether something is or is not a tax expenditure, it can still be somewhat academic as long as the legislature weighs in on whether or not there's a sunset. Reasonable people will disagree about whether something is a tax expenditure. It's really just a deviation from the tax base. So the legislature has authority to define the tax base, and they did so on a couple of major ways in 2019. And some things were taxed and some things weren't. So if the items that weren't taxed, are those tax expenditures, or are they just not part of the base? And economists and people can have this academic debate, but as was highlighted here, what is the consequence? You want clarity for the taxpayers to know if something sunsets, as well as the Department of Revenue, if they're administering the tax. And it could be other agencies. And I mean, transportation taxes are one that we're going to get to at some point. And those have another flavor to them. But the goal here was just to make sure all the committee members are on the same page as to the tying of these two provisions in law has created this problem, whether it's an awkwardness for DOR in putting something in the book, but ultimately, did a provision of law sunset? Did it go away?
Representative Marsh.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So we can enter this conversation by trying to be more precise in our understanding of what a tax expenditure is, or we could enter it in having a discussion around what we think should sunset, which is kind of a different place to start that conversation. And that's a significant question, because anything that sunsets should, in order for it to continue, is going to take some sort of legislative action. So by definition, that should be a fairly, I think that should be a fairly high level item, because it's going to provoke, if we're going to put a sunset on it, it's going to have to be acted upon every 6 years by this legislature one way or the other, or else we just let it go. So I'm just wondering if that's another, looking at what we appropriately think should sunset is in some ways an easier conversation than defining what all things are tax expenditures, because that's a very broad pool. The pool of what should sunset is a much smaller pool.
I think that's a good point, Brett Marsh, because it really gets at the core, the technical piece. Now, how that gets carried out, if it's a change in the definition of the automatic sunset, we can bounce up to slide 4, or if it happens somewhere else. And for a lot of provisions, it's on the radar screen for the revenue committees, but it isn't necessarily on the revenue screen for other committees that handle. And transportation is one that jumps to mind. Mm-hmm. Now, we do, Mazin follows transportation, and there's been some cross-pollination between the members. But it's the point being, it's broader than just the revenue committees.
Many, maybe most of the tax or revenue related proposals, maybe I should just stick with many, do start in a policy committee. And the process and the discussion issues raised in a policy committee are different. And what you've just mentioned is it doesn't really include some things that are left for the revenue committee then to contemplate. But I'm wondering whether it's desirable for something sort of like a suggested format for policy committee conversations, as well as revenue impact statements, to make sure this topic is raised? Or maybe it's really more appropriate to raise it after it gets to the revenue committee, if it is indeed subsequently assigned to revenue committee.
To that point, Chair Nathanson, the revenue impact statements at the bottom, there is a sentence there, a question, does this create, extend, or expand a tax expenditure? And we check yes or no. And then try to get some language around a policy purpose. As a matter of course, the economists in the office proposed language, and then try to get feedback from the committee on what that language is. Because evaluating a tax expenditure requires understanding what the policy purpose is. So what we've been doing for a number of years on our revenue impact statements is that policy purpose, as well as this checkbox. So I think that may help, may not, and John can probably chime in about when DOR is going over these, to what extent, if that box is checked on the revenue impact statement. I don't know that that's legally binding is where I'm going with that.
Sure, and is that degree of work provided when a proposal is being first debated in a policy committee before it gets to revenue committee?
Yeah.
And maybe there needs to be something even more specific about sunset date, because in a policy committee, when you're less familiar with the jargon and the concepts, you probably don't get it what it means about tax expenditure. But I think you'd get it right away if you saw the phrase sunset date.
Yeah, please.
Mm-hmm. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. John, if you go back to your two examples, 1 and 2,
I feel like I'm at the eye exam, the eye doctor.
So example two, if that tax had been passed in 2019, and I'm a manufacturer of a blue, pink, green, orange highlighter company, my desire is that I don't make your book. Because if I make your book in 6 years, I'm going to have to be back at the legislature begging, borrowing, doing what I can to make sure that that sunset gets extended another 6 years or gets rewritten into law. Whereas if it doesn't make your book, I just continue life as normal. Is that a proper assessment or taking your analogy and carrying it out 6 years?
Madam Chair, Representative Reschke, I think this kind of goes to what Representative Marsh was saying, that there really are two issues here, what sunsets and what's in the book or what meets the definition of a tax expenditure. And we're going to take the position, I think, that being in the book by itself does not make something a tax expenditure. To Chris's point about who gets to decide what a tax expenditure is, we don't think inclusion in the book should have that kind of legally binding quality. So
probably something else
would make them sweat more, but they might sweat a little even if we put it in the book and yeah. Say we don't think this meets the definition of a tax expenditure. That certainly okay. Raises the visibility of okay. The product.
Yeah. All right.
And one under the category of awkward. Aside from everything.
That's what yes. I dominate that category, but go ahead.
We are talking about the tax expenditure report. So to include items in the tax expenditure report that aren't tax expenditures is another layer of yeah. Awkwardness. And I know there's been some confusion, and I totally understand the path forward about, well, maybe this is, maybe it isn't. But just another thing to consider, not to stray too far away from the key point about being the sunsets. And the tricky part can be if the discussion is had, then there can be that deliberate decision. The trickier part is if that discussion isn't had, then mm-hmm. Then there's almost no chance for a sunset. And that may or may not be the intent.
Representative Kinney-Geyer. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering if, to me, it seems clear from these examples, my own interpretation, that the first is a tax expenditure and the second is not. But I wonder if there was a lot of debate among you that this seemed really fuzzy, and I wonder if other members of the committee feel that, because maybe it's just not written somewhere, and maybe I'm interpreting it wrong, and there's the example of why it needs to be more clearly delineated.
Madam Chair, Representative Kinney-Geyer, I think the first one to most people would look like a tax expenditure if there wasn't a really good definition of base that would naturally exclude the blue. One of the rules that has been suggested for the definition is that the tax is established on the day it's enacted, and so any subsequent exemption might be a tax expenditure. I'm not sure that would be satisfactory to most people either, because you find kind of mistakes or you find that maybe the base was defined differently than you wanted when you first enact something. On the second example, I think again it probably matters what the purpose of the tax expenditure is and if there is a rational reason to exclude the other colors. I think my natural inclination would be to think that is a tax expenditure because it's treating similar products differently, and without a very clear rationale for that, I would think it would be a tax expenditure.
Morning, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. For the record, Mazen Malik with Legislative Revenue Office. So I've been dealing with a number of tax expenditures in the past, and there are some that are a lot easier to consider, and it becomes an easy platform, if you will, or an easy way of analyzing tax expenditures. Those are the ones that are connected with transportation, especially gasoline. And why is that? Because gasoline, for example, is taxed at the highest levels, so everybody pays the tax. At the beginning, then you do have a certain types of expenditures
in the form of exemptions or refunds for the tax. So forced product tax, for forced product vehicles, for an example, they get a refund. If they would not have gotten this refund, this amount of tax would have filtered to the state appropriation process. And that's the main idea, is the tax expenditure taking away this amount of money that otherwise would have been paid as a tax, and it would be appropriated by the Ways and Means Committee. So that's why it's an expenditure. If it's expended before it gets to the Ways and Means Committee, although it comes through the state collection process, so we collect the tax, but we refund it at a certain time, and the refund does not actually enter into the budget process versus any other ways of doing it. So there is a conscious choice by the legislature, for example, to exempt vehicles used for testing emissions. And that's a clear tax expenditure, because otherwise they would have paid. And if you want to compare it with the blue pens, if any tax would have raised money for the state coffers, and that tax would have filtered at the end to the Ways and Means appropriation process. If you are doing a policy as a committee or any committee in the legislature, and that policy exempts certain types under that tax because of a policy to push forward certain goals, then that's how you would obviously relieve them from paying the tax, and doesn't reach the appropriation process, and it's expended a lot sooner in the payment process, if you will. That's the way we look at it.
Any other questions or observations on this agenda item? Again, not our last opportunity to discuss tax expenditures and sunset dates. Representative Breschke.
Well, and I think you would, thank you, Madam Chair. I think you had mentioned it a little bit that these things should start in policy, or do start in policy committees. And if the law is written well, will be more like example one. And we're not stuck with 6 years. 6 years is just the default. So if you want a tax expenditure that's 10 years or 20 years or indefinitely, write it into the law that way. So it's the intent is clear, and then that would make, I know John's job a little easier, but we like him to work hard for his money. So that's a, I know he does. Mm-hmm. But I think you're right in that we probably need to swim upstream a little bit to help make sure things like this get written as intended, as opposed to just being left as the default.
Anything else? Thank you both for your comments. Thank you, Mr. Allenack. There's no other business before us today, is there? We're done. We're adjourned.